This is David Siegel. This is Saturday, December 6, 1997, and I am very fortunate to have sitting in our kitchen in Yorktown Heights, New York, Patricia Hosley. Am I pronouncing that right, Pat?
You are. It's so good to hear it.
Patricia is a veteran of the golden age of radio, and I am fortunate in that she has agreed to sit with me this afternoon and chat a bit about her career as a radio actress. Let me begin by asking you, how did you begin? How did you get started as a radio actress? When did this happen and how?
Oh, it happened many years ago, I'd say 1943 and 44 and 45 were the years when I was in New York City. But when I said I was glad to hear you say my name, Patricia Hosley, because that is my maiden name, and now I am married, and my name is Pat Kibbe, and that's the name I use as an author of children's books, which I am at this point. I became an actress when I left Southwick, Massachusetts. I lived on a farm in Massachusetts, and I had actually should have gone on to college. I had a scholarship, but I went to a summer theater the summer before I graduated from high school, and I met a wonderful man there and got a job in this summer theater, actually washing dishes for all the actors. But I loved it so much, the acting part of it, that I decided, instead of accepting a scholarship and going to Wellesley or some wonderful college, I went to New York and I went to the American Academy. And from that, when I graduated, I started making the rounds, and I wanted to be an actress. And actually, in those days, we sort of, you know, didn't think that radio was really acting. At least I didn't. And I accidentally got into radio. A school friend of mine knew Elaine Carrington, who was very famous, writing a lot of soap operas. And at that particular time, she had written a Broadway show, and they were casting it. And my friend from back on the farm told me that I should call her and possibly get a reading, because he knew I was interested in the theater. And I did call her, and she was kind enough to ask me to come up to her penthouse and to meet me. When I got there, she told me that, you know, I was much too young, and there were no parts for me, and she asked me if I had ever done any radio, and I said no, but at that time I had done a part in a show where I used a high squeaky voice in the theater, and so I just did a little part for her that I had done, and left her and went back to my apartment, and told some of my actor friends that I had met Elaine Carrington. And then the next day, the telephone rang, and I answered it, and the voice said, Pat Hosley, and I said, yes, and the voice said, this is Mrs. Carrington, and she had a very sort of affected voice, and very deep and grand, and I wasn't sure it was her. In fact, I was sure it was my girlfriend who I had told about the visit, imitating her. And so when she said, this is Mrs. Carrington, I said, yes, like that. And then she said, I'm calling to tell you that I've written a part for you on Rosemary. You know, and then I said, yes. And then I began to giggle. And then she said, this really is Mrs. Carrington, and I've written a part for you, and it's called Bird Brain, and be at a certain studio at, you know, CBS at a certain time. And then, of course, I realized it really was, and hung up, and in a couple of days went to the studio, and did the part, and it was perfect for me because she had written a part just like the part that I had had in this little show. So that's the way it started.
That's a wonderful story.
It is. I love it.
Now, soap operas, of course, were always a continuation. Uh-huh. It would go 15 minutes each day and for weeks and weeks. Do you recall how long you were on that particular show?
Oh, I was in and out, and I would never have too many consecutive times on it because it was, you know, it was a little it was a girl's, young girl's voice, and she talks like this, and so I said, I've never met a soldier before. It's got me all frustrated.
Somehow.
And she would be giggling, you know, so they didn't dare bring it on too much.
That became your specialty because I have a sense, based on what I heard at the convention, that you really specialized in children's voices.
Well, young voices, but I was young at the time, and it was just my voice, which I guess I sort of still have. Anyway, that sort of, you know, started me in radio. But I was still looking for jobs in the theater, and I did get jobs in the theater, but I also got married, and I married the boy I went to high school with, and he was, at the time, just getting out of the Merchant Marine. War was over, and he decided to go to college and then law school, so I was delighted because that meant that I could really get into radio and the theater. So he stayed right in New York.
Now, I checked your dossier before this visit, and the two Bibles of the Golden Age of Radio, the John Dunning book and the Buxton and I can't remember the other fellow, credit you with appearing on two major programs, Frank Merriwell and Brighter Day. They don't list you under any of the others, and that's their mistake. Tell us a little bit about the two that they credit you for, the Brighter Day and Frank Merriwell, and then we'll talk about some of those other shows.
All right. The Frank Merriwell show was at NBC, and it was a wonderful show. And by that time, when I got on the Frank Merriwell show, I was pretty much into radio.
You were a continuing character on that show.
Yes, I was somebody's girlfriend, if I recall.
Let me see.
I think it was,
Elsie Bellwood,
Elsie,
title that was given to you. Here
right,
it is.
Right, and we did that Saturday mornings at NBC, and it was wonderful, but in the same time era, I was doing Archie Andrews, you know, at NBC in the morning. But the most important step for me in radio, I think, was my husband had started college, and I was looking for work, and we lived in this little ground floor apartment in the Murray Hill District in a brownstone, and it was wonderful, except neither one of us had any money, so I used to try to get into radio, mostly for the money rather than, you know, count on the theater all the time. And I wrote postcards, and that's when they were penny postcards, and I wrote to all the different shows and directors that I thought, you know, might be able to use me or that I'd be right for. So I did write to Lester Vail at Young and Rubicam for a part, or at least an audition, on The Aldrich Family. Lester Vail was a wonderful, wonderful person and great director and everything, but he was a little, how can I say it, he didn't really concentrate or didn't have time to focus. And evidently when he received my postcard, he just saw it in front of him, and what I put on the postcard was that I had just finished a part, and I believe it was I had a Broadway show on the town where I did one of the little girls on the subway, and I mentioned that I you know, had been in the theater because Lester loved the theater, and that I, although I was in my early 20s, I guess I was 20 at the time. I said I had a very young voice, and I thought that, you know, I would be very right for the Aldrich family. And just when he was reading my postcard, the telephone rang, and it was another producer saying that he was going to have a show with John Robert Powers, the famous model man, and he needed a young teen, a young person with a teenage voice who had had a little stage experience because it might be a Broadway show. And as he was saying what he needed to Mr. Vail, Lester just saw my name on the postcard, and he said, "Oh, here's somebody, Pat Hosley," and he gave my answering machine, a radio registry's number, and the man hung up and called me. And that job turned out to be 5 15-minute radio shows a week, and also half-hour shows. And then eventually had a few television shows at Dumont.
What was
with
the
John Robert Powers Charm School, they called
the
it.
The name of the program, the radio program, was Charm School.
John Robert Powers Charm School.
That's fascinating.
And Peggy Allenby, who was a dear, dear friend, wonderful actress, she was on it. And Ken Lynch, who was another wonderful actor, and myself. And Ken was sort of in charge of, all the exercise classes at this charm school. And dear Peggy was in charge of all the beauty and the poise, and she would talk about that. And I happened to be the little mail clerk and sort of, person that would have to do the exercises or ask the questions. And it was wonderful because we would work together for 15 minutes every day. And then I believe we followed with a half-hour show or something. It was unbelievable. And that whole wonderful program put my husband through college and law school and let us stay in New York.
Was this still in the 40s or was this in the 50s?
No, this was in the 40s. No, 46, 47, I believe it was.
That's a program that is not well-known among those people who collect old radio programs.
I know, and I'd love to find, anything to do with that because, as I said, I was on every day, and then it was just the beginning of early television down at Dumont, and we were down doing those shows, but Mr. Powers wasn't an actor to begin with, and he did a lot of strange and said a lot of strange things not meaning to. And this, of course, it was live television. Oh, I don't know. I'll try to think of some of the things he said, which were just so crazy. But it was a wonderful period for me. And I think it was on at least, from at least a year, the whole just continual thing. So it was a wonderful. And then eventually Lester did hire me or call me for the Aldrich family.
Who was playing Henry at the time that you were on the Aldrich family?
Oh, Ezra Stone always was playing Henry.
That's something that I remember we chatted about that briefly at the convention, and when I checked the listing for cast for the Aldrich family, I see all kinds of names. And again, our friends Buxton and Owens don't seem to have found
my name.
Your name is.
I played Gladys, his girlfriend, and I was on for many years, really. And Joe Scabetta was the director, and Lester Vail and Ed Durer. I worked for all of those.
If you gave me the dates, I could probably check some of the programs and find one where you were on.
All right. I'm not certain right now, but I can go home and figure out the dates because Norman Tokar and Ed Juris were the writers at the time. And Phil Sharp, I remember, he was on. He was there. But Ed and Norman took and wrote the television Henry Aldrich show, which I was on. And then they started a special television show called Young Mr. Bobbin, which starred Jackie Kelk, and I played Jackie Kelk's girlfriend on that Young Mr. Bobbin. And I can remember going to Washington with Washington, D.C., for a parade Norman Tokar and with Ed Juris. And I don't know whether that was for the Young Mr. Bob and Television Show or whether that was the Aldrich family, but all that happened in the same period when I was on the radio show. And I always worked with Ezra Stone and with Jackie Kelk.
Who played, was Hal Seamus still father at that time?
Uh-huh, yes. And I didn't know anyone that replaced either one of those. I thought, I know in the television version we had lots of, you know, different people on it, but I don't recall ever doing Aldrich family without, was it Kay Roth who played the mother,
right.
And Hal Jameson and Ezra Stone and Jackie Kelk.
Well, Henry got into a lot of trouble. Henry's forte was always getting into trouble and getting out at the very last minute.
Yes, it was so sweet. And then the Archie Andrews show was, you know, sort of like that also.
Were you on that with Bob Hastings?
Oh, yes. Bob and I are very close friends. Mm-hmm. And Rosemary Rice, who was at the convention also.
Right. Rosemary, you mentioned. Brighter Day. I just happen to have, I actually found a photograph of you. It's not a very good one.
Oh, we had such a wonderful time with this. And you know that Jack Lemmon did his very first radio show on Brighter Day. And I got to be a friend of Jack Lemmon's. Maggie Draper, just called me 3 days ago. She's in New York. She's writing. And what I think would be wonderful if we could... And Jay Meredith is a dear friend of mine. Maggie Draper, Jay Meredith, and I were all on Brighter Day together. And we have kept our friendship all these years. And we meet at least once a year and have lunch together. And now Maggie is in New York writing a book, and Jay lives, I know. Anyway, her daughter lives right here in Connecticut, and she comes and visits her quite often. We'd love to do a Brighter Day script at the next...
Well, you better tell her. You have to let Jay know that.
Because we could really just, you know, it would be so wonderful.
Do you have any, have any of you kept any of the scripts?
I don't think so. I think, you know, I'm sure. Here I am also in this picture.
And
there's Maggie.
Terrible Xerox, but it's still, you can still see who it is.
Dear Bill Smith. Oh, golly. Oh, this is lovely. Ah, it's just wonderful. I'm sorry.
No problem. Now, how did you get selected for Brighter Day? Is that the program that you were on the longest? If you can think of a program, a continuing show that you were on for an extended period of time, which one would you say lasted the longest?
I really can't. There's so many, and most of them were, as I said, with my voice, I never had a leading lady role, and I never did, the bad guys. And whenever I would get a part, it would always be, you know, with a little bit of comedy in it or things like that. So,
casting director looking for young child.
No, not young child so much as just the good friend or, you know, for a little comedy relief and that sort of thing. But I will have to go home and just sort of, you know, think about all the wonderful times. And I can remember, I was always very busy. And I can remember being in a show where I have to, and I'm sure many have told you this, where you'd be at CBS and you'd, you know, have the elevator waiting and you'd have to go down and get it, and you'd have a cab waiting and you'd get over to Rockefeller Plaza and then you'd have an elevator waiting and you'd run up and maybe open the door and you'd get a script and you'd go right on. It was wonderful.
You two were part of that rat race, where you actually were on two or three shows on the same day at different studios.
Well, I wasn't as busy as people like Bud Collier, who's a dear friend of mine, and he was always so wonderful and so busy, but we did do a lot of catching of taxis and running, you know, to another studio on the other side of town. It was wonderful because radio was alive, you know, and early television was that aliveness which none of it seems to have now. And the very fact that it was instant and you were there and you were doing it just had some sort of excitement and truth to it that was lost after all. Everything became recorded and, you know, things.
Did you have an agent, or did you do all of your casting on your own, or did all of your job hunting on your own? Once you were known, people just called you.
I think really I didn't even know they had agents in radio. I think in the theater I worked with Sarah Enright, who was a wonderful person, and I had several different agents. But in television I did get an agent or two, but with radio, it was, I think, more or less just
word of mouth.
Word of mouth, and the directors that you would work with, you know, and would like you, and thought of you for different parts. I can remember doing a lot of my true stories and Whispering Streets, and quite a few of those morning shows on ABC.
Was there a time that Betty Davis was on Whispering Streets?
Oh, I don't remember that. No, I don't.
That was I'm not sure if that was a continuous show or that was just a different drama each time.
No, it was a different drama each time. And you're mentioning a star like Betty Davis. I can remember doing some of the Theatre Guild shows, and I can remember...
Homer Pickert?
I don't even know whether he directed, but he must have, I guess, the show I did. And I've got to think of the name. I can't, but anyway.
I have a list of Theatre Guild shows. I can help to revive your memory.
Yes, because I really, you know, and when I went back to the conference, it just seemed as though it was yesterday, you know, instead of how many years? What is it? 50 years or more. And I just felt as young, and I felt as though, you know, I could just go and do, you know, tomorrow. And as a matter of fact, my dear friend Abby Lewis, who has just passed on, you know, this Thanksgiving, when we were at the conference this last time, she mentioned to me and gave me the names of some agents, because I guess a lot of everything now is agents.
Right.
And she said I should really get back and do some more voiceovers.
You have a great voice for cartoons.
Well, yes, I did a lot of...
And commercials.
I did a lot of commercials. I did voiceovers for the Cocoa Puff commercials for years, and I did all the commercials, you know, Listerine and Axel House, and especially in the beginning of television, because I blended right out of radio, you know, right into television. I started working in television in 46 and 47. So
not too many of those kinescopes around these days. Fortunately, there are radio programs that still survive, but not much of the very early TV.
Well, and those kinescopes I did give to the museum, the ones I had up in my attic all those years.
Check your attic and see if you've got anything.
And those great big records, you know, that they...
Transcriptions
that we
had. Oh, I would have killed for some of those.
School of the Air. And was it We the People or something?
We the People. Milo something or other.
I don't even remember the names of, you know, now the people.
People Speak.
But it was a wonderful, wonderful era. And it just seemed, when I was back, you know, this October, that it never ended, that it was still there. And for the first time, and I really have to say this, I really loved all those people that are collectors and that do have an interest in all this radio sort of era, because I realized how important it really was and how much good was in it. And I think when you compare the different medias and the way we're going now, you know, with the radio and the television and now the internet, you see that we're getting further and further away from the real truth about everything. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I, being a child of radio, I certainly do.
Radio
presented more than innocence. It really presented something that...
It's so real.
Right.
I mean, it was you listening, it was you doing it, I don't know, it was just part of you.
Was this the first radio convention that you've attended, or have you been
to
the radio
convention
before? No,
I went to some, quite a few years ago, and even 3 or 4 years ago, but I never felt myself so involved in it. I think it was because of, I don't know, my life has been in wonderful different eras, I guess, with the radio, and then from that getting into the television, and then from the television getting becoming a writer. I'm an author of children's books. And
speaking of writing, did you or other cast members get involved at all with the people who actually wrote the scripts to any of the soap operas or the other continuing programs that you appeared on?
Not really, no, except with the Aldridge family. I felt Ed Jurist and Norm Tokar, you know, were my friends. We went to parties together. We were sort of a family that part of the Aldridge family. And this was during that period when they just were when television was just becoming, getting its feet on the ground.
Was Clifford Goldsmith around at that time?
No. Maybe he was, but I didn't know him the way I knew Norman and Ed. But it's strange because my life, I think, with television, with radio, it was wonderful because I started having my family, and it didn't matter. You know, you could be very, very pregnant and still be doing your radio shows. And with television, you know, it was wonderful in a way because I did work with a lot of different directors who knew I was, you know, having my family, and I did have 5 children. So they got used to me being pregnant, and when they'd call me for a job, they'd say, tell me, are you pregnant? And I'd say, which do you want? You know, because I had many calls for one show, General Hospital, and it was supposed to be a teenager in the hospital, in the bed. And I, at the time, in real life, was about 9 months pregnant, but my director friend said, that's right, I want you, and I'll put one of those, you know, movie magazines in front of your stomach, and you can be in the, he said, you don't have to get out of the bed or anything, he said, so everything's great. But I think secretly he was hoping that I would give birth during the show on General Hospital.
That would have been dramatic.
And then I did another one at FBI and Peace and War. I think that was when it was on television. And I had to play a young unwed mother. And it was about blackmailed babies or something. But
did you ever play the FBI on radio?
Yes, I did. Just a few times, I believe. I wasn't, as I said, my voice and my... whatever I did the best wasn't with the crime and with all those
right.
Big, deep shows. Although I did do a lot. I seem to, you know, I forget a lot of them. And then in television, I was on The Honeymooners, you know, and I worked with Jackie Gleason, and it just seemed to, everything blended right, you know, from one, from radio into television. And then when I had my family, I went back to college. I went to the new school, and I still go there, to this wonderful writing class, and began writing about my children, and having some books published.
People often talk about live radio and some of the funny things that happen when either someone forgets a line or goofs in some way. Do you have any memories of any embarrassing moments, either for yourself or for some of your fellow actors in any of the shows that you were on?
Oh, gosh, I'm sure if I went home and thought and then came back, I would have many stories for you.
We'll have to have a chapter two. This will have to be like a serial. Continued next week.
Oh, yes.
We'll get you back. We'll drag you back here.
Oh, I would love it.
Rehearsal time. Was there much time devoted to rehearsal?
Yes, actually, yes and no. It depended upon the people you were rehearsing with. Because we had so many fine actors, and it was such a wonderful experience to, as I finally learned, that, you know, radio actors are the same as any other type actor, whether it's television or on the stage. I mean, if you're an actor, you act, and marvelous, marvelous people that I worked with and friends. And the rehearsals, you know, some would be, you get in with some of them and you wouldn't start fooling around or talking or laughing, and it wasn't casual at all, especially, you know, with programs like the Theatre Guild, you know, and you really, and but then there were other other directors and other casts who, you know, were so used to their part, who were very, very casual, and yet always gave a wonderful performance. And I sometimes you worked with directors who were pretty rough to work with and who weren't, were more interested in, you know, cutting and getting the show on. And I had the director when I was on the John Robert Powers show, and because Mr. Powers was not, you know, a great actor, a lot of time would be spent with him and what he had to say in the beginning and the end of the program. So sometimes we'd get on the air and he would go, you know, beyond his timing, and the director would have to come out, and while, you know, we were doing the show, the director would grab pages and start cutting, you know, and then put it back in front of you. And it was really, you have to be awake and alive, and it was really sometimes very difficult. But most of the shows were fun, and with the Aldridge family, it was when everyone knew one another and really loved one another, you'd do the show. But then, you know, we'd have to come back to repeat the show.
For the West Coast.
Yes. And some would go out for dinner, and some would go back. I would go back to my little apartment, and then I'd go back to the studio. And sometimes people would be late, and sometimes not as careful with with their readings.
There are several stories about people who were perfectly sober for the East Coast broadcast and a little less so for the West Coast broadcast. Do you have any recollections of that happening? Not to yourself, of course, but to others in the cast?
I certainly have, but I would never tell you that.
Okay.
No.
We won't put you under duress. But that has occurred.
But, yes.
Okay. You're being very discreet.
Yes.
There was a time also when a lot of the radio moved from the East Coast to the West Coast. Were you ever tempted to move west and join some of the broadcasts that were done in Los Angeles? Or did you always stay in New York?
No, I stayed in New York primarily because, as I said, I was there in the beginning with theater and always hoped to continue more in that than I ever had a chance to, because then my husband graduated from law school and we did move to the suburbs and began our family. So I always sort of stayed right in the city. And now, really, I'm still in the same suburb, and I would like to go back to the city. I really would love to get back into voiceovers and things. And maybe you'll be the start of all this now.
Well, let's hope so. Let's see what happens. We're getting close to the end of this side, but we'll let the tape continue until it ends, and then we'll try. This is only 45 minutes, so we'll try the other 45 minutes and see what we can squeeze out of you, and then you'll talk about your writing career and your education career, your new life. On the air bloopers you don't want to talk about, or you want to go back and see if you can remember some of those. You did move to the West Coast. Did any of the programs that you were involved in move west without you?
Well, actually, no. I think everything sort of just began, or you know, with television, you sort of slipped into that, and the radio, as it did go, and actors did leave for the West Coast. I was very busy in television, so I just didn't notice or realize, I think, what was happening to radio.
Radio officially, radio is still going, of course, but the what we call the golden age of radio officially died sometime in 1960. They say the last programs that were broadcast were Gunsmoke and Suspense, and a few shows like that. The big show with Tallulah Bankhead was one of the last major radio programs. Wondered whether or not people who were active in radio as you were could see the handwriting on the wall. In other words, see fewer and fewer radio assignments as more and more people were watching TV.
Well, I think that because I did think of myself as an actor, you know, physically too, and not just, you know, in the radio part of it, I think that I was very excited about television, so I really didn't have a concern about, you know, everything sort of petering out in radio. I think I just was immersed in...
How about some of your colleagues who were not TV kinds of people? Like, for example, Ezra was... You could listen to Ezra on the radio and think of him as a teenager, but if you saw Ezra... he just couldn't play that part on TV. You wouldn't think of Ezra Stone in terms of a TV persona.
Right. Well, you would, really. Not as Henry Aldrich, certainly, but Ezra was a fine actor, and I think if he had wanted to, he could have, you know, become more of an actor than he was.
But
he, yes, but he, when TV started, he took his talent and became a director, and I suppose other of us did, you know,
I'm just wondering about the radio, the psyche of the person who was, I don't know if you ever knew a person named Ann Elsner.
Yes, I did.
Who played, was it Stella Dallas?
Uh-huh. Or? Oh, I don't know what she played, but I know what you're getting at. And actually, it was the same with when sound came to movies, wasn't it? I mean, certain stars who looked beautiful.
Voices of voice.
And so now the radio people with wonderful voices, they didn't look that good with the body that went with the voice,
well,
or it just didn't match.
I guess that's what I'm getting at,
whether
or not you knew of any situations where that might have hurt careers.
Well, you know, I don't know, because I think if you're an actor, you know, you can do all these different media things, or you train yourself to.
One of my friends, who is particularly a Frank Merriwell fan, asked me to inquire whether or not you had any memory of the writer of that program and particular history of the Frank Merriwell show. That's a very popular program because Frank Merriwell started off in the teens, I think, as a popular pulp magazine
character.
Magazine,
yes. Right. And I remember Hal Studer, who was also on that, the actor, and Fred Way, who is a very dear friend of mine and was a very great director on NBC. He directed part of that, I believe, and I'm trying to think of the other NBC directors, but I didn't recall working with any specific writer because they rarely were there when the actual show was done, that I can recall.
How soon before the actual show did you get a script for any of the programs, the soaps or the serious dramas?
Oh, just when you walked into the studio.
For rehearsal?
For rehearsal, yes.
Uh-huh. And did rehearsal take place on the same day of broadcast, or was that a couple of days earlier?
Oh, no. The rehearsal took place the same day of the show, unless it was a big show. I'm trying to think because I'm getting confused with the early television shows. But the actual radio shows, you know, you just go in and you'd read it once, and then you get up at the mic and have your dress rehearsal, and then you'd be on the air. And usually, it wasn't more than an hour and a half or so that you'd be in the studio or 2 hours.
The soaps were all done without audience, but yes. Henry Aldrich was done with an audience, wasn't it?
Henry Aldrich was done with an audience, I believe so. Yes, for part of it, because it was in NBC, wasn't it, in 6 a.m.
So you could hear a lot of the audience as you listen to the shows.
Right, right. Well, of course it had the audience. I'm trying to think of some other shows that I...
Theater Guild would have an audience.
Uh-huh. And I did some shows with Bob Hope, and NBC had a series of specials on Saturday night where they had stars come in. I'll have to just go home and think for you and come back with all these wonderful names.
Now, did you have to dress differently when the audience was there than you would have if you had done it before just your colleagues?
No, I don't think so, because I never did. I think, you just dressed, but people did dress... for the shows. I mean, everybody, when thinking back, everyone always looked very well dressed, but, casual. But not quite as much like like an actor. The actors, that are in the theater are dressed and look a little different than the radio actors did. I mean, this is what I am recalling, But
well, you have a different career today.
Oh, I have.
And I know you want to talk about your activity with regard to children and an international exchange. How did you get involved in this one?
Well, I started writing when I began having, when my five children began to grow up and go off to college have careers of their own. I suddenly found myself alone in this big old house here in Yorktown, and I asked myself, what is it that I've always wanted to do and never had time to do before? And I remembered when I was very young, in the third grade, I wanted to be a writer. And actually, I wanted to be a writer until I decided I was going to be an actress. So I hopped in my car and I went to the new school in New York City, the School for Social Research, and I went to into the office, and I said to somebody, I want to be a writer, and the person said, well, tell me about yourself, and I said, well, I have five children, and before I could say another word, the guidance person, as I guess it was, said, I have just the class for you, and put me in this class called Writing Books for Children. And I wrote my books in class, actually, and my first book was published by Knopf, and Scholastic did the paperback, and then I wrote another book about my children. My husband running for mayor here in Yorktown, and that was again published.
Was that published under the name of Pat Hosley or
no,
Pat Kibbe?
No, it was Kibbe? Pat Kibbe.
Your husband finally gets some credit.
And then I wrote another book, Mrs. Kibbe and the Moon Booms, which was Macmillan and published, and everything was going just beautifully. The books became very big hits, and I began touring around the country, actually talking about writing to kids in schools, and it was wonderful because it was kind of the beginning of that. When my children were going to school, they told me later that, you know, they never had a real author come to the schools and talk. And I was fortunate that when my books came out, they were just beginning to realize how important it is for authors and people to go visit and talk to kids. So I was visiting a school in Vermont, and then while I waited to go into the classroom, I was reading a newspaper and opened up to this article, and it was entitled Children on the Border. And I didn't even know what border they were talking about. This was back in 86. And it was the border between Thailand and Cambodia, where there was a refugee camp. And it showed the children that had been pushed out of their country, of course, and were living in the refugee camp.
Ready to begin again. Do you have your script ready yet, Pat?
Nope. But I'm thinking and remembering when I was waiting outside that classroom I was telling you about and seeing that article and the postcard that the little boy was holding was a postcard, the picture said underneath the picture, this little boy is holding the postcard that the photographer who was inside the refugee camp taking these photos had given this little boy. And it was a picture of the Empire State Building, the postcard. And underneath it said, this little boy is holding his prized possession. It's probably the only thing he has or owns. And I was so taken by that picture, and I guess it was because I'd been writing about my own five kids in this wonderful house and picket fences and the wonderful fun and joy of an American family, and then suddenly see the barbed wire fences and realize how many kids were living, you know, behind a different kind of fence. Anyway, I went into the classroom and still in the back of my head thinking about that picture. And so when the children started asking me questions, and one of them asked me where I got my ideas to write, I told them, which I always tell them, you know, you write about what you know the most about and what you love. But I said, look at this. And I showed them the picture of the little boy holding the postcard, and I said, I'd love to write a story about a refugee boy. But I said, I don't know anything about him, and I just have to do some research before I can write. And I went on talking, as I usually do, you could tell.
Anyway, I'm going to try to get you to overcome your shyness.
I was talking, and one little kid raised his hand and said, Pat Kibbe, can we write to that little boy that's holding the postcard? And I said, oh, no, we couldn't write to him because he doesn't speak our language. But I said, you know, you could draw him a picture. And then I went on talking again about myself and writing. And another little kid raised her hand and she said, but Pat Kibbe, if we draw a picture, will you see that that little boy in the newspaper gets them? And I didn't quite know what to say, so I just sort of shrugged my shoulders, and I said, well, I'll try. And then I went on talking. Anyway, I finished and continued after I left that school. There were many other schools that I was engaged to speak at, and I kept with me that newspaper and always sort of showed the children in the classroom the newspaper, because indeed I started to write a book about a little refugee boy. But inevitably, every school I visited, every class I went into and showed that picture, some kid would say, you know, how can we communicate with that little boy? And before I knew it, I was getting boxes of piles of pictures that kids in different schools had drawn. And I got the boxes here in Yorktown at my back door and began to feel so guilty that I went to Washington, D.C., and I went to this organization, Refugees International, and I met the director, and I explained that I was writing a book and I needed, you know, slides or information about refugees. But I said, I also have this box filled with pictures for this little boy, and I showed him the newspaper article. And I said, could you possibly get these pictures to this little boy? And he said, not only will we get these pictures to this little boy, but he said, we'll send you there to deliver them.
Wow.
So within 2 weeks, I bought a video camera and had my passport and was able to get everything in order. And it was, you know, and the fact that I was an author and I was going to for information for a book, and also that I had these precious, wonderful pictures that had been drawn by American kids for another kid. I got over there. I got over there to Bangkok. I flew from New York to Bangkok and was met there by a guide and driven in this sort of half truck, half car out into the country, up to the border of Thailand and Cambodia to Camp Khao Dang. And I had all the pictures with me, the box with pictures. And when I got there, it was just like I'd seen in the slides. You know, you have barbed wire fence, you have a man with a gun at the entrance. And it was amazing that I even got in. And you know, they searched me, and you know, there were missiles and things going on. It was quite, you know, dangerous at the time, and I had to sign these things, you know, that they weren't responsible for me. And but I wasn't even aware, you know, I didn't even stop to think of all this. I was just so excited about maybe getting these pictures to this little boy. And so I got in the camp, and within 30 minutes, after, you know, 30 minutes out of 35,000 at least little kids, you know, in, you say, elementary school, that size, out of 35,000, they found the little boy that had been given the postcard. And you know why? Because everybody in the camp remembered the day, which was months ago, that the photographer had come to that camp and given the boy the postcard. That's how much anything means to people, you know, who are in a position where they're not getting any communication at all. Well, anyway, so I met the little boy and his mother and his little sister, and it was really quite sad because the mother begged me to take the little boy back with me, and it was an amazing experience.
How old was the boy?
The boy looked to be about 10, but he was, I think, 14, because what happened, we went to the school, and the school was nothing but just a thatched roof, you know, standing on poles and dirt floors, and I passed out the pictures the kids had made, and within like a day or two, every single picture was gone. I mean, it was like it just disappeared. Either, you know, there's so many kids, and every kid wanted to to touch something that was a piece of paper that had colors on it, that was something from another kid for them. And, you know, the initial experience was so exciting because I had all these kids and I was giving out all these pictures. But then within a week, and by the time I left the camp in 2 weeks, there was nothing left. And it was because the kids, well, there were so many, but also because, you know, the floors were just dirt. It was just dirt. And every, you know, the hands and the pictures were just paper. So I got home and realized that, you know, that wouldn't work. But then I got the idea of kids making picture books for kids, where the books could be laminated and bound. And so that's where Kids to Kids International started. I had schools, I went to visit schools and got schools interested and teachers interested in having their children, their pupils create books, picture books. And then we laminated them. And then the United Nations asked me to go back to that camp in 91 for Rights of the Child Day. So when I went back, I took hundreds of picture books made by schools into the camp, found the same boy again, and everything is just from there. Just, it's wonderful now. I could go on and on.
We've got to get you some publicity off the record. Let me shut this off for a moment because we'll get back. And if anyone who might be listening to this tape in the future, Pat has promised to return with more memories and more details about her radio career. But I'm going to try to chat with her for a few minutes about moving on this children's program that she's so excited about. So let me say goodbye for a few moments, and who knows, maybe we'll return.
We will return.